Hi, I know you've been waiting for this for weeks now. Come on, we can do it together. Let it go. Just let go. Give it up.
It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
Happy New Year again. We are back in the saddle. We've had potholes openings. We've had equipment breaking. We are back, baby. Welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am still Tim Callender.
It is the winter of discontent. And I'm still Jeffrey, stuck in Los Angeles where it's 80 degrees. Wow! It was beautiful today.
Yeah, we don't like you much.
Yeah. It's Phoenix. It's beautiful here, too. So.
Yeah, it was like 65, 68 today.
Most of the country is wrapped in a white blanket of death.
Yeah, I went for my morning run, and it was 28 degrees.
Yeah, I saw something about -4 in Minnesota, and I'm like, ha ha, glad that's not me.
Yeah, sucks to be you. It's a good thing we don't have any listeners in Minnesota, right?
So despite our techno problems here, we managed to pull off yet another episode. I really thought, like BCS, I thought I was going to get a bye here, but no.
That's good.
Yeah, that's all you need to know. Hey, look, over the holiday, there's some JMS news going.
Flash.
Yeah, Gary sent in some information. I kind of did a little digging to follow up on that. And I got a couple things here to kind of share with you. The first is from a website called Collider.com. And this is part of an interview with JMS. And the question, of course, is how close is Forbidden Planet to the original? And Joe responds, I think if you're a fan of the original as I am and have always been, I think it's very faithful to that. We've actually decided to show more of the Bellerophon when it first arrived 20 years earlier to sort of counterpoint what's happening in the present story. But Warner's is very excited about it, thinks it's a big franchise for them and a huge budget, so they're very much oriented toward getting it done. Next question was, did you complete World War Z? And the response is, yes, I wrote 5 drafts. Is it close to getting done? JMS says, one never knows. The director is attached to it, and Paramount really wants to see it done because they have a lot of money invested in this thing. They think it could be a really big film for them. And then additionally to that, comicbookresources.com announced that part of the DC Universe, DCU in 2010 marketing campaign, DC announced that JMS has been tasked with taking the Man of Steel to new heights in an ongoing series of original and reimagined graphic novels entitled Superman Earth 1. JMS, a lifelong fan of The Last Son of Krypton, will deliver a 128-page story once or twice a year, beginning with the release of the first volume on September 7th, 2010, which will be illustrated by rising star artist Shane Davis. And what we know about the project, apparently he'd been working on this for about 18 months. And the question that was pitched to JMS from Comic Book Resources is, how was it pitched to you, or did you pitch it to DC? And he said, they came to me. Basically, they said, we want to introduce Superman more thoroughly into the world of mainstream bookstore publishing, and we want this to be a vehicle to do that. You're going to have a clear field to handle it however you want. You don't have to worry about continuity or other characters. Just tell a good story. So in the midst of all this, he's working on a pilot for Fox, which is, at this point still has no title. Yeah. And out of all this, you know what I come away with it?
He's a busy guy.
And there's no Lensman.
Yeah. No, Lensman was mentioned.
Yeah, working on it. That's what it said. Working on it.
Working on it. Doesn't mean
it should be. It should be top priority. Should clear his calendar.
Whoa.
Ooh.
Just, wow.
Just, you know.
You know, here's what I'm taking away is sounds like everything, as Joe had already proclaimed a year ago, you know, it's nothing but big budget stuff from here on out for him, right?
Yeah, right.
So, Mr. Deep Pockets, as the three of us sit here and continue to espouse your genius and let B5 live on, how about sending some of them dollars over this way and sponsor our show, you know? Get those Warner Brothers people to start running ads on our podcast here for other great properties that you're involved with.
Well, it's kind of a no-brainer. You'd think that they'd figure that one out, huh?
One would think.
You would think. Hey, whatever.
Oh, well.
Bring on the big budget.
That's right.
If it's good enough for JMS, it's good enough for the Farpoint Media Babylon podcast.
That's right. Hey, Mikey at home and not at a job, you would see incredible things out of Farpoint really soon, real fast.
Yeah, it's like Mike's hair.
Yeah.
There you go. He'd let us drive the company jet again.
That's right.
Yes.
It's been parked for a long time.
Collected dust.
Mike ran out of scotch and started drinking the jet fuel.
I had to.
Why do you think his hair came
show
back?
Sober, do you?
So what else anybody got here for news and excitement?
Saw Avatar.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Like what, 5 times, 15 times?
I saw it twice. I've seen it twice. That was enough. I just wanted to get the 3D experience out of my system. I've done it. Now I'm good. Time to move on.
So the 3D is like this way, that way, and that way.
it was actually pretty cool. It was a beautiful, beautiful film, and I enjoyed it for the beautiful, beautiful film. So there you go.
Everything I've been hearing about.
Yeah, it's not much of a story. I mean, it's a story we've all seen. It's Dances with Wolves in Space. I mean, absolutely. And
it's a story of a man named Brady.
But I don't care. I'm not a big fan of Westerns, and the fact that it's a really beautiful world and seeing that story told again there, I'm good with that. So
yeah, okay.
I was good with it. I mean, it's not Iron Man, but it's definitely worth a watch. It's I put it in the same category as Transformers. You know, it's pretty, it's a lot of fun, and it's something you just got to see just because you got to see it.
So kind of right up there with Legends of the Rangers?
Something like that, yeah.
All right, so why don't we go ahead and take a break and come out and do some deep geeking. What do you think?
I like that plan.
All right. Make it.
How to continue a television series after a major actor has left the cast.
Part 4, The Robin of Sherwood Method.
Remove the character from the scripts and replace him with an entirely similar character. Create a highly elaborate scenario that puts the new character into the same situation as the original.
The transition is completed when the replacement character adopts the same name as his predecessor. For more about British science fiction television, listen to the British Invaders podcast
at www.BritishInvaders.com.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is B.
And we continue our march towards the bright shining light that is the end of season 5. But first, with the fallout in Fall of Centauri Prime.
Yes. Yes, this is an interesting episode. I have to say, going back and watching again, one of the things that really impressed me was Londo's transformation. You know, the way his outer demeanor changes we as viewers know what's driving it, but all the characters around him are taken aback, but almost are kind of like, well, okay, he's emperor now, and that changes a man.
No, I think they're more than surprised by it. Everyone, including Veer, they're completely stunned by the way he's shut everybody out, the abruptness with which he's shut everybody out.
Sure, but I mean, how much of that, you know, they know something's up, but, you know, do they just simply say, well, okay, he's emperor now, and that's what we expect?
No. What do you think? No. I don't believe they expected that. I believe once he told them the story of how the regent did this and it wasn't us, but we're going to pay your reparations and nanny boo boo, we turn our backs on you kind of thing. I think a lot of it came from them just figuring, okay, he's emperor now, he's got to put on a strong face. But, you know, when he's not in front of his subjects, he could still be himself with us. And the fact that he couldn't do even that was a surprise to them.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think Jakar had a sense of it. I think he had the sense of it for the right, you know, the right sense, but for the wrong reasons. You know, when Londo bids him farewell and says things are going to change, you know, I'd be with you through everything. Now that has to change. And Jakar was like, okay, I understand. I get that. And I think he understood, again, not perhaps the source of it, but maybe, you know, I don't know. That's the way I came away from it. I think that Jakar at least understood that Londo had to become a different person to simply be emperor. I tell you what, that scene is one of the most moving scenes in the whole show.
Which one?
What, at the end when Londo, you know, before he accepts the keeper, and he goes to Jakar and says, you know, it's time for us to part ways. And, you know, that final recognition from Jakar, you know, my people can never forgive your people, but I can forgive you. And, you know, that's where true peace really begins, is at the individual level. And that was just, I mean, it was moving.
Yeah, that was touching and poignant and made even sadder by what we see that Londo has to do next.
Yes, right. And it's a true sacrifice. I was just thinking, you know, the montage they have, the various quick clips starting from, you know, the season one all the way through the future where Jakar's strangling him to death. You know, it becomes less cheesy montage, but the fact is, you know, symbolically he is dying by accepting this thing.
I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yep. He's no longer Londo. At that point, you know, he's a tool of the Drak, except when they allow him his freedom, in which case he just gets himself blind, stinking drunk.
And drunker.
Now we're talking. Hear that? You hear that, Michael? You paying attention? No, he went out to go get some more scotch.
Yeah, are you sure it wasn't the keeper calling him out to do some sort of nefarious dirty work?
Exactly.
I got to tell you what, that was gross when the Drak pulls the little baby keeper off his chest.
Yeah,
it's like
a little extra slime that.
Nasty, just gross.
It's gross.
That's good stuff right there.
That was, you know.
It was worse than watching an equipment malfunction at a bikini contest. All right.
Of course, you know it is. That's not even a contest.
No, you know how they use the glue to hold the the place, and you have a glue malfunction, and there's this residue there when they it's just nasty.
I can't say I've ever witnessed that.
Yeah, so no, I don't. But I'll thanks for the picture.
Yeah, right.
You obviously have never gone to any bodybuilding contests.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Just out of curiosity. That's
while I've used that as an excuse oh so many times.
Okay.
So the you know, one of the other things that I did notice with the makeup for the Drac, there are it has this head bone structure that's very similar to Minbari. I shouldn't say very similar, but it has echoes of Minbari head bone structure, and I like that because I like the concept of the Minbari as an ancient race and the Drac as an ancient race, and you know, given that basically Lorien was a progenitor of the entire universe or the entire galaxy's life, higher life forms. You know, I like that there is that kind of echo one in the other.
I hadn't really seen them as a similar race kind of thing, because one looks kind of lizardy.
Right. I'm not saying the differences. There's a reason I use the word echo. It's less that one is similar to the other. It's just that I like that the design recalls some of that Minbari look, which to me, again, you know, indicates at some point a similar genesis back in the mists of time. You know, it's not that they're cousins, you know, or even, you know, relatives, but just at some point, I don't know. I don't know if I'm making any sense or not.
Not yet.
Okay.
Try again.
There you go. Well, no, it struck me this time.
I got to say, I just always wanted the Drac to be something different than two eyes, nose, and a mouth kind of character. You know, they were so mysterious leading up to this. They were so deadly. They were so different. Not that I wanted, you know, like Vorlon vapor floating around or anything like that. And I don't know what I mean by that, whether it should have been a CG character or it should have been some very, very, very elaborate costume or whatever, but it just is sort of, and I'm sure it was just all product, you know, just in terms of the storyline, I just always thought the Drac should have been like something we had not seen yet.
Wayne was the Drac, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe that was the whole thing. They just needed to put, you know, we need a costume that fits Wayne. So
do you remember how long it took to make him up as the Drac? Did it take longer to do him as Lorien, or do you know?
I wouldn't guess. Oh, I would guess that Lorien took longer.
Really?
That's just my guess. Yeah. Lorien was pretty sophisticated headpiece and all that stuff. So my guess is that Lorien would have taken longer. Because when you look right, you know, if you look at the Drac, it really is not all that far from Drazi. It's just got some, you know, the back end of it's got some more aerodynamic stuff going on.
Right, right. And that's more of a
he's got a spoiler.
He's got a spoiler.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good call, though. But, I mean, it's good because the Drac headpiece looks much more like an overall prosthetic, whereas Lorien had bits and pieces, and you've got to work to mask that so it looks like it's all part of the actor's face.
I do see what you're talking about, how the way it sweeps back kind of reminds you of some of the Warrior cast.
Yes.
The head bones in the Warrior cast, but just the facial structure beyond that didn't seem to fit to me.
Right, no, exactly, and that's why I'm saying it's an echo, one of the other. You know, there's not a direct line that you can trace to link them up. It's just like, anyways, I just thought that was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. Alien du jour. Right.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, to be fair, you know, the first time that we see the Drock was that dancing red eye glowy guy.
Right. Right.
You know, and that was a different look, which, you know, begs the question, was that truly a Drock? You know, he said it was a messenger of the Drock. That doesn't necessarily mean that he is a Drock. But having said that, I thought it was a more impressive look than the dancing guy or even the aliens with the buzzsaws from Movements of Fire and Shadow.
And if you have keepers like that, you know, that they, I don't know. I think I wanted some kind of Jabba the Hutt kind of thing going on, I think.
Big wormy thing?
Some kind of, around. Yeah, exactly. Something totally, totally different. Not right. And no offense to Wayne. He did a great job. I'm just saying. Not Wayne walking around with a headpiece on.
Well.
That's all. I'm past it. Moving on. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the exigencies of budget for that show. I mean, that's as much as any. I mean, that's what generally all science fiction on television. It's like, it's cheaper to put bumps on the guy's nose than to make Jabba the Hutts.
Yeah.
So, Pizza the Hutt, on the other hand, that's a different story.
I don't know why that always cracks me up.
Because it just does.
It just does, right?
It just does. So we also get the terrible revelation from Lanier to Delenn as they're floating in hyperspace, and four Centauri warships are closing in on them. And I don't know which was more terrifying to Lanier, was to make the declaration, I love you, or to realize that he really wasn't going to die.
Because
that's when he falls over, is when they realize, you know, we're going to bring you aboard. And he's like, plump.
He's like, oh, crap. That, he said, I said that in my outside voice, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, seeing that's one of those moments where, okay, we're going to die. If I wait five more seconds just to make sure we're going to die before I say it, will this be a good thing?
Yes, right, right. And Delenn, you know, I mean, she is trying to provide Lanier with an opportunity to save face. Oh, I wasn't quite sure what you said, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, God, it was so pathetic. You know?
Yeah, it's Amy, how do you take that? Is she giving him an out, a graceful out, or does he take it as being dismissive? It could go either way.
Right. And I think from Delenn's point of view, she was trying to give him the out, but he, you know, you could just tell in his expression, it's like, oh God, I've really stepped in it now.
Mm-hmm. I've stepped in it, took a swan dive into it, rolled in it. Came up, went back in for a second try.
Yeah.
That's going to leave a mark.
Oh.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's the other thing. This is, you know, Jeffrey, your issue was with the Drock creature. My issue in this one was energy weapons that recoil.
I don't remember.
Well, they're
on the ship
on the ship. No, on the ship. No,
on the ship. The ship. When they were lost in hyperspace, they said they could fire their last remaining ammunition, but the recoil of it, since they didn't have inertial stabilizers, would actually propel them in the other direction, which is like pushing them farther off the beacon.
Right. So they'd be drifting forever, lost in hyperspace.
Yeah, well, but it's inherent when you have a ship made by Hyundai or Kia, something like that.
I don't know. It was just
budget.
Like,
it's all budget.
No, I wonder if you could give them a pass on it by saying hyperspace behaves differently than normal space.
Oh, it's how the weapons function. You could see it in the CG that they were bouncing like it was a revolver.
Yeah, it was silly. The spaghetti western part of our show.
Right. It was. And it was the Star Trek part of our show, too.
Right.
To set them on automatic, press the green button once and the red button two times. What?
So you have more. Your problem is with the bounce, not that there was the, you know, equal and opposite reaction thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I could have accepted it if you said, okay, you know what, we're going to fire the beam weapons, but the, you know, because they're a beam weapon and it's going to, you know, not such an immediate thing. You know, this is going to provide thrust. We're going to drift off. Who knows if we'll, you know.
Buckle up.
Well, no, the explanation was there. You know, we have no attitude control, so therefore there's no engines going
to stabilize
it. Stabilize us, but yeah, it's the 45 like bounce that you
have. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's a little bit problematic.
Yeah.
More like 357.
Yeah. Like, feel lucky, Linear.
Yeah.
He did until they.
Yeah.
Until he thought he was going to live.
Right.
Yeah, I had to go and say that, didn't you?
Come on, it was obvious. It was obvious. So, what else did I like about this? I liked. I thought it was weird. I'm not sure how I feel about the giant Londo projection. When he basically announces to the people, here's the plan, they're trying to break us.
Mm-hmm.
It was like coming attractions.
Why do you have the problem with that? Because we've already seen the Minbari do that.
Well, no, we haven't. Have you seen the Minbari? The only other precedent I can think of.
Wheel of Fire. That? The Wheel of Fire.
No, but it wasn't projecting a giant Delenn or Naroon.
They said that was projecting everything that you see to everybody. You know, they'd be able to watch.
Right.
Just because we didn't see it watching it.
Right, but I assume that meant everybody was gathering in sports bars to watch the Delenn versus showdown.
No.
That's how I took that.
I did not see
a pay-per-view.
I did not see
Delenn versus Naroon.
Right. I did not see a broadcast truck anywhere in there.
Mm-hmm. No, that's because it's all miniaturized. I mean, I get that. It's, you know, you had the Len cam. You know, it's something attached to her head bone.
And it behaves differently in hyperspace.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's got bounce and lift. So the other precedent we would have been Sheridan using the great machine to project himself throughout the station. Mm-hmm. Announcing, you know, the breakaway. But even that's a closed environment. This was like over the capital city. You know, it was 900-foot Londo.
Satellite.
It's not that it was like good or bad. It was just like kind of, huh?
Satellite relays. Huh?
I guess. Something. I like that. I like the whole concept of him walking alone to the palace.
Yes.
For so many reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, and the bell tolling for every Centauri who died in the bombardment. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was pretty heavy. Yeah, I like that.
Well, the whole thing was kind of heavy. You know,
the thing was,
let me, here's one for you. Mr. Tim Callender knows everything about everything.
Here's the hypothetical, what do you think
would have been, let me rephrase the question, do you think that this episode could have been the last episode if we just got to the end of this episode and just stop the series right there?
No, because I really think in the end you need sleeping in light to cap it off. I would agree with you that the following three or four episodes, while I wouldn't say necessarily superfluous, they're more about closing out different character threads.
Right. It's leading up to it, but you could have ended with this one.
Because it closes out a story. Yes, I agree with that.
Because this what I remember most was that it Now, were they flashbacks or flash forwards? But coming in shadows.
Yeah, coming in shadows, right?
Right. That's where we foresaw the finality of all of this. We didn't know it
yes.
for 4 years or 3 seasons after that, but.
Right. Right. Londo has his dream and he sees the shadow vessels flying over and he sees the great hand and then he sees the vision of Shakaar strangling him to death. Now, obviously, so, that's still in the future, but yes, you can make that. And we, of course, see it acted out in War Without End. So, yes, I agree with you, Jeffrey. If you've stopped the story, I mean, this is a good resolution for that story because, in a sense, we already know what the next resolution is that's already been given to us, and there is a finality. Yeah, you know, those who would count themselves as friends of Londo, you know, as Summer pointed out, you know, he basically shuts them all out, including Veer.
I think if we would have ended the series on this episode without saying anything, it would have left everybody going, wait, whoa, and instantly we would have had a sixth season.
Yes, there you go.
I don't know. I don't know if we would have gotten season 6, but you know, I for one, I think Objects in Motion is necessary because there's just some fun stuff in that episode, darn it.
Oh, I'm not saying that Objects in Motion and Objects at Rest are wasted episodes. Not at all, but those are more closing out threads on particular characters, whereas I see Jeffrey's point. I think that Fall of Centauri Prime closes out the arc of the story. And then you've got Sleeping in Light as a poignant epilogue to the whole thing.
There you go. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And not that there was anything wrong with the way it happened. It's just... It just seemed to me that this was the one that kind of you got to the end of this episode and you said, well, there you go. Now I know the story of B5.
Right. Exactly. Because the rest of it is just simply shutting the doors and turning off the lights.
Right.
Yep. It was this is the, how did she say, the new alliance would shake, would falter, but not
fracture.
Break.
Right. Yes, it would fracture but not break. And yes, that's exactly what it is. You know, here's the one thing that struck me in all this as it's not until this episode that the violence is described as a war. You know, at this point everybody's, you know, the Narn and the Drys are like, "Well, we've won the war. The problem's over with," and it's like all the other stuff, the raids on shipping lines and the various battles were never portrayed as a war. You know, there was only one really, frankly, one military campaign, and it was just the Drazi and Narn coming to bomb the crap out of, you know, the homeworld. And that was it. Pretty short war, but I guess it was a war.
Well, it was a war from the time, I guess you could say the other races got themselves onto a war footing with the start of the presentation of the evidence.
Yes, right.
That got their dander up, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
And from then on, they were looking for payback.
Yeah. And here again, I think this is one of those episodes that really drives home the concept of what happens after Happily Ever After. You know, this is the messy aftermath. You know, we beat the shadows. Woo! We overthrew President Clark. Whippy! You know, Earth is wonderful. You know, we're all friends again. But there's all this other mess and all this other tangled stuff that went on. And... You know, and this is how it resolved. You know, it wasn't a happy ending by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it only adds to the poignancy of Jakar's comment to Londo. You know, I can forgive you.
And in literally the long and short of it, that for our story arc, that's all that really needed to be said. I mean, economic ties between Narn and Centauri could later on happen, but at this point in time, we really don't care.
Right.
What we care about is the relationship that we've seen develop and change and twist several different times. And from the moment Londo said, "I'm sorry," in the very long night of Londo Malari until this point, you know, I can't forgive, you know, my people can't forgive your people, but I can forgive you. Yeah. That's sort of like the opening and closing of the final arc that leads to what we see happening 20 years later.
Yeah, right. Right. And how very different the characters have become from when we first see them in Midnight on the Firing Line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm getting verklempt.
Aw.
No, because, I mean, I think, you know, from a broader scope, I think this is one of those seminal moments, certainly in science fiction television, where you see characters go through those transformations and get to those places. And I think it set a bar that all series afterwards have you know, striven for and raised in some cases. But I, you know, in terms of just the giant story, we've never seen anything like this.
I just found that final quote from Malari. I found this on Wikipedia here. It says, "In the Centauri Royal Palace, Londo sits alone and sits on his throne. Behind him, the capital city continues to burn from the Narn Drazi attack. It is the ultimate irony when Londo states that once I had all the choices in the world, but no power at all. But yeah. Now I have all the power in the world, but no choices at all."
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Right. And, you know, to speak of irony, you know, the Drak to coerce Londo into taking the Keeper basically pulls the Londo move, where Londo had ceded the island where the shadow vessels had been hidden, you know, with fusion bombs, and sacrificed Centauri lives to blow that up. But then comes the moment where the Drak basically says, "Okay, we've got bombs all over the capital city. You know, if you don't acquiesce to the Keeper, I'm pushing the button." And, you know, Londo gives in at that point. Because bizarrely enough, for all this self-serving aspects of his character, down deep, he really thought he was doing what he thought was best for the Centauri Republic and its citizens. But
he was a major, major patriot.
Right.
The pinnacle of patriot. Absolutely.
Right. Right. But as it's pointed out in a number of places, you know, at one point by Lanier, you know, if you're doing the right work for the wrong reasons, that work is corrupted. And, you know, this is the ultimate result of that.
Well, yeah, except you can't, as a patriot, as a part of the community, the world, the forces, the whoever it is that you represent and you are being a patriot for, if you're not the person who gets to make those decisions. See, that's the thing that, like, that Lanier is what you can't do is go, "Gee, I know this is wrong, so I won't do it." No, that's not the way it works. If we say this is our destiny, this is our choice, this is where we're headed, and you are a true patriot, you go that path, even if you know it's not, it doesn't sit well with you.
Right.
It wasn't like the Centauri had a democracy that you could kind of go, "Yeah, no, I tell you we don't want to do that. That's not nice."
But my point is that his patriotism in some sense was misguided, or maybe a better way to put it is that at the beginning he was too caught up in faded glories and the concept of restoring that, as opposed to, instead of looking to the future and going through painful, necessary pain to build something new, he strove to recapture glories of the past.
Well, yeah.
And by doing that, the choices he made ultimately undermine all of that. And that's the irony there.
You do run into this problem where your patriotism can conflict with your politics. And Londo's, I'm not sure he was ever completely clear on his political, well, I don't want to say clear on his political direction, because I think his foresight and it had been forced on him. He kind of knew where he was ultimately going to wind up. So that derails someone's that sort of derailed his political aspirations, because he already knew endgame.
But, well, no, I don't know. I come back to what Lady Morella tells him. You know, we say it's fate or prophecy, because that takes away, you know, because we've already chosen a particular path, and we say it's destiny because we don't want to try to choose anything different. I'm horribly paraphrasing that now, and I know somebody's going to dig up the exact quote. But Morella's point in the prophecy was that it's not set in stone. You have the opportunity to change those things. You know, it's only, you know, only by saying it's fate and resigning yourself to quote unquote fate, you're basically surrendering your choice. It's not that you don't have choices, that you give up taking control of that. And I think what happens with Londo, ultimately he has to take the Keeper because that's the last choice he has, even though it's no choice at all. And he embraces it because, you know, that scene where he finally takes it and he throws off his coat and his waistcoat and the you know, his scarf. There's this almost defiant look on his face, and I get the sense is that he's, rather than dreading the choice he has to make, he's actually embracing it to say, at least I'm doing this of my own free will, even if it's the last act of free will I have.
Yeah.
Summer, what say you?
I think we have something else to argue about besides Day of the Dead.
Oh, yeah?
The short answer is, because we still have voicemail to get to, the short answer is, I believe he's using patriotism as a shelter to hide behind. I believe he thinks he doesn't have a choice because of the visions he's seen, and that might just because he doesn't think he can change what he's seen. Part of me thinks that he's trying to be noble, but another part wonders how much of this is him trying to be a martyr because he still wants to save himself later.
Well, but a martyr doesn't save himself. Well, a martyr is all about sacrifice.
Well, I guess
Byron's a martyr.
That's the wrong word. He's given up. He's not going to fight anymore because he thinks that he will have. It's like he doesn't want more people to die. But the fact that it takes 20 years for him to do anything about it, 20 years with how much of that was Veer running the underground later?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. You know, it's been a while since I've read the Centauri, the first two books, and I don't know that I ever really read the third one. I got the sense that it really wasn't. You know, it was maybe 5 years down the line. It wasn't that really that long a time.
Anyway, yeah. I see.
You're right, Summer. We're running out of time because Menengay's giving me the
he's giving you the
yeah. He's going. He's giving you. You know. But you've just opened a whole new can of worms here, because the whole thing between Londo and Veer, I mean, we haven't, that's a whole nother relationship that is coming to a close here. And we have
far more to talk about in future episodes, and I'm sure Gary's already called in 3 voicemails of already.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We will return to more deep geeking later in future voicemail segments, but right now we have our own voicemail to catch up on.
Okay, fantastic. You're doing great. Now push and release. There you go. Okay, one more time.
You've got to be kidding.
This one more time. And push. And, oh, there you go. Mrs. Johnson, congratulations. You have a happy, healthy inner geek.
Aw, man.
Sponsored by Technorama, who reminds you to geek responsibly at chuckchat.com.
And we're back to cover the rest of the voicemail that came in while we were on our holiday break.
Yes. The hiatus, if you will. What are you snickering about?
Michael busted me about.
We know that was scotch induced. So.
No, I have no scotch.
Exactly.
I have no scotch. I have no alcohol tonight. I did this show sober.
I wish you would have done that 184 episodes ago. That was funny as hell. What we're laughing about, folks, is that he brought to my attention. He didn't say it at the time, but he brought to my attention that
I was laughing too hard. I couldn't help myself.
Coming of Shadows, not Coming in Shadows, which Michael proposes would have been a wonderful porn title for the show.
every movie, every show has its porn equivalent. So Coming in Shadows, there you go. That's the porn title of the day.
Okay, well, I'm glad the cameras aren't rolling, because I'm like beet red right now.
Friend of the show, Kate from Chicagoland, sent in an email that says, "What did you say, Tim? Training super extra hard with your fighting pole?"
That's the sequel.
Yeah. Now you know why they stand alone on the bridge. The darkness. Exactly.
Good stuff.
All right, so let's roll some voicemail before we.
Yeah, we haven't heard from Gary yet.
Hey, Batcaster, this is Gary from Jacksonville. Hey, I'm just sort of curious. I'm listening to you guys deep geek, and we're talking about Sebastian a little bit. And I wonder how many other times he's been unfrozen. Now, if they took him back in the 1880s, that means he could have been actually unfrozen to test Balin to see if he was the right person to lead the Shadow War at the time. Let's make for at least a nice, interesting short story. Oh, well, I guess we'll never see it, but it's nice to fun and speculate. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Well, you know, that does beg the question, how many times have the Vorlons tested whoever for whatever purpose? Because there is an implication from Sebastian that the Vorlons have used him for this before.
Yeah, I got the impression that he'd done this at least 3 or 4 times before.
Yeah.
But there really was no shadow tester, right?
We don't know.
We never got. Yeah, we didn't get into that part of the story, right?
Yeah, right.
Hey, Batcasters, it's Gary, and I'm listening to you guys geek on. I think it's Darkness Ascending, and you're talking about Garibaldi and his sink down. And you know, I realize we're not quite at the end yet, and I don't know if you guys are going to have a special segment where you actually talk about some of the beginnings to endings and what changed and developed along the way. I know you guys always touch on it. at some point during an episode. But, you know, I think about the two friends, Garibaldi and Mallory, and how where they both sort of started off in their relationship. They both seemed to be in good places. They both went to abysmal pits. Yet Garibaldi was able to pull himself out where Mallory didn't. I'm just sort of curious where the differences stand. Is that because Garibaldi got selfish and, you know, wanted a good life for himself, sort of as he went on even when he was on under Bester's control? And Mallory actually was the self-sacrificing one who wasn't selfish and ended up paying the ultimate price? Just a few schools for thought. But at the end, I really hope you guys do a sort of, you know, review back on, you know, where Babylon 5 went to in the course of all these 5 years. Maybe a nice little summary episode at the very end of the series. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Isn't that what we've been doing for 184 episodes?
You could say that.
I would say this about the difference between Garibaldi and Londo. Is that even though Garibaldi hit rock bottom, the fact was that there were enough people around him who cared for whatever fashion to help pull him up. Whereas, as we commented during the deep geeking, Londo shuts all the doors. It could be that Garibaldi was too drunk to lock the doors, but...
And also, you have to look. Londo's a diplomat in a position of power. Garibaldi was in the military and the security, and not really didn't feel ultimately responsible for his entire planet.
Yeah, right. There is a difference in scope, sure.
But he did feel responsible for the people who cared about him, who he felt he hurt by letting them down. So there's a similar sort of wanting to atone, but there's a huge difference in scale.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Bathcatchers, Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm a little off topic, but it comes up in the show enough that I wanted to mention something. Jeffrey always talks about that Heavens Above website and how he's able to locate the shuttle as well as the space station, and honestly, I guess I don't quite understand the coordinate system as well as I could or should, and I never quite seem to get it right. But NASA released a new app for the iPhone, and when you go to either the shuttle or the space station section, there's a little graphic that looks like a line drawing of a globe, and when you hit that, it automatically pops up the shuttle and the space station wherever over Earth it is at that particular time. And I played with this once in a while, and just the other night, while the space station and the shuttle were just separated but still pretty much in the same orbit, I saw it was coming over Jacksonville, so I went outside, and sure enough, I finally got to see what Jeffrey's always talking about, and I got to see the space shuttle and the space station moving quite quickly but very clearly through the night sky. It was really a lot of fun. So if you guys... can't quite get that Heavens Above app to work, or at least don't know where in the hemisphere you're supposed to look, I might give that NASA app a try. It's really easy and intuitive. Take care, guys. Bye.
Very good. Wonderful. Wonderful. Glad he got Gary, to do that.
Gary, buy me an iPhone so I can try it out.
Well, we're going to get JMS to get it with all those big bucks.
Oh, that's Yeah. Forgot about
big,
that. Sorry.
Big budget. No, it is truly. It is an amazing experience to see it because once you see it, it just makes sense to you. Go, wait, that is way too high to be an airplane and way too low to be a star. You know, yeah. you know what you're seeing, and it does. It moves by the sky. And I've had that same opportunity, Gary, a few times to see the two of them side by side, you know, or not actually side by side. The shuttle go by, and then you'll see the station come right after. And sometimes I've seen them when they're very separation. It's amazing. It's really, 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 really cool. Heavens Above is, yeah, I mean, it's not super slick. It's pretty good old basic programming, but you just go to the court. You know, you say, yes, I'm in the United States. Yes, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida. And it's really not that hard, Gary. You're a smart guy. So, and then it'll just tell you, it'd say it's going to come out of the west northwest, and it's going to be approximately 10 degrees, and it's going to apex at, you know, the due west at a certain degree, and then it'll fade off to, you know, east or something. I mean, it'll tell you exactly which path it's going to take and how high into the sky it's going to be. And I got to tell you, it's like down to the minute, it is really, really accurate. It's great stuff.
Hey, Fabcasters, it's Gary, and gosh knows when Tim is actually going to listen to this, number one, and number two, actually get it onto a show. But over the hiatus, our own Miss Summer Brooks had a birthday, and I just wanted to wish her a very happy birthday. I hope she had a great one, and I'm sure everybody else wants to join in and congratulating her for yet another year spinning around the globe. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Woohoo! Thank you.
Happy birthday to you.
That's right.
Happy birthday to you.
To you. You
new podcast. And you look like one too.
I was going to thank you guys for serenading me, but geez, now?
That's as good as it gets.
All right. That's it.
That's it?
That's it?
That's it.
That's it. That's it.
Oh, hey.
So it was a Gary-a-thon?
It was.
It was. So Gary single-handedly kept our voicemail line active.
That's Gary's good at. He's good at keeping that line alive.
Bless you, Gary.
That's the start of 2010.
2010. The year we make contact.
We wish.
2010.
Do we have time for emails?
You got a few minutes, a couple minutes.
Okay, here we go. You ready?
Sure.
One comes to us from Mike Smithwick.
This isn't more about your stick, is it?
No.
Okay, no. Just curious.
That out of the we took care of that one first.
Okay, well.
I could use a nap now, but.
Suddenly I want a shower.
Well, you got the curtain. Mike Smithwick writes, in episode 178, you were talking about the complete lack of any B5 fan films. Obviously, you have never seen Star Wreck, one of the most ambitious fan films I've seen. It answers the age-old question that has no doubt started numerous ballroom brawls from the Zocalo to Rigel 7. In a fair fight, who would win, Captain Kirk or John Sheridan? What started out as a crude Star Trek animation on a Commodore Amiga ultimately ended up as a 90-minute full-length Star Trek Babylon 5 parody film, all in Finnish, no less. They definitely follow the Hollywood model by making the trailer much more entertaining than the actual film, but still it's pretty impressive. So go check out www.starwreck.com, StarWreck.
And we had those guys on Slice of Sci-Fi a few years back, yes.
Yeah. So, and I must admit, I have not yet made a point to go check that out, so I have comments.
It is pretty clever, and it's a very Family Guy style animation, but you don't care. It's good stuff.
Gotcha.
Well, are you done?
No, I got a couple others here.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
This one's for you, Summer. This comes from George Brickner, another regular contributor. Garibaldi's Big Gun and Darkness Ascending looks similar to the BFG 9000 in the first season episode Babylon Squared during Sinclair's Flash Forward. Back in the old days on the CopyServe Science Fiction Forum, I asked JMS if we'll see that gun again, and he said we probably would. So here we go. Here's another one. This is aimed right square at me. Tim, listening to the latest podcast, which is no longer the latest podcast, this comes to Steve from the UK. So he says, I think I know why you dislike Day of the Dead. You're a self-confessed Trekkie. You, like many of us, love Star Trek. Episodes like The Inner Light are good character pieces that rely on the sort of dubious technology Trek excelled in. You bought the concept in that episode because it's what Trek does. Day of the Dead uses the same type of plot device, and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because the B5 universe doesn't work like that. B5 was, for 99% of the time, rooted in good science, to the level that NASA copied ideas. But when it used the sort of dodgy storytelling Trek relied on, it stuck so far out it just didn't work. The magic of the older races and technomages was still based in science, but Gaiman, for all his love of the series, just didn't realize that the B5 universe is a more, quote-unquote, grown-up place to play. Anyways, that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it. Keep on the great work, and please bring back Yarstow. We miss him. Like, we've got Yarstow in a box in a closet.
Right. He's down at Guantanamo. We haven't let him out yet.
It's your turn to feed him.
Oh, man. But I was going to Tashi Station to pick up some power converters.
Hey, what'd you have there, Summer?
I have a message regarding B5 parody songs. Now, if you remember, before we went on break, I was complaining that there weren't enough Babylon 5-related parody songs out there. And over the holiday, Jim Styles found a band called Psy Fried. Psy Fried Band had done a parody album called Ramming Speed. I think this
is your porn, Mike.
Well, I was going to say, we just can't get away from the euphemisms tonight, can we?
There's your porn, Mike. Yep.
We're into triple and quadruple entendres, aren't we?
We are. I don't remember if this was their second album or their first album, but this entire album has parody songs from Star Trek, Star Wars. They have one track that's a Babylon 5 track, which is what Jim was telling me about. They have several very cute sounding songs. And I had mentioned to Jeffrey about, you know, the parody of Lowrider by War, which I read. They have one called Tatooine, which is a parody of Cocaine, Eric Clapton. But the Babylon 5 one is For Whom the Babylon Tolls, which is a parody of Metallica, For Whom the Bell Tolls. And after I posted that on the website, one of the guys from the band emailed me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he says, hi, this is Jim Frederick from Psy Fried. I saw your post about our parody album. Very cool. Thanks. I thought I would send you a little info about our band and a copy of For Whom the Babylon Tolls in case you want to play it on your show. We are a six-piece geek rock band based out of Orlando, Florida. Not far from you, Gary, are they?
Right. Nope, he's in Jacksonville.
Yeah,
Florida's a little sliver of a state. It can get there.
He can get there. Really,
it's about 3-4 hours, probably. But
yeah, but he doesn't have to drive in snow and ice, so he's good.
That's true.
He says we actually have two albums. One is called Geeks Unite, and is all original music about ninjas, pirates, Star Trek, Star Wars, and video games. The other is called Ramming Speed, and is all parody rock songs about zombies, Star Trek, Star Wars, and various geeky things. We play live at shows and clubs, sci-fi convention, and on January 2nd, 2010, we are kicking off a tour called 2010, the Year We Make Contact. You know, they're sci-fi. And they actually are going on tours to different conventions. And I had tweeted on January 2nd that they actually performed live at a club in Orlando. And there's a website out there called SyncLive.com where you can actually watch these live shows broadcast over the internet from these little clubs. This place has like hundreds of bands from different clubs on different days. You just have to find your band and your day if they're on there. I'm like, whoa, that's kind of cool. So I tweeted that was out there for people, and people, our listeners, will be able to hear For Whom Babylon Tolls. At the end of this show.
All right. We should get those guys on.
We should.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea.
We should talk to Jim and get a couple of the guys from Sci-Fried on here to talk about their plans to give us more Babylon 5 parody songs, I think.
Yes, right.
Because the world needs more.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we need more songs, you know, about ninjas and pirates, obviously, but we definitely need more Babylon 5 parody songs. It's a necessity in my book.
It is like air or spoo.
Okay, there you go.
That's it.
There you go. That's I think so. I got one last quick little shout out thing here I want to do and this is relative to the geeking that the Fall of Centauri Prime was directed by Douglas Weiss, who was one of the great great. He still is. He's just a tremendous person. He was such a great asset to the Babylon team. He was director for many, many episodes and got it. Episodes, and indeed he was related to the great director Robert Wise, who had done Star Trek the Motion Picture, the original one, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Run Silent, and Andromeda. Very cool. So anyway, you know, just Doug's awesome, and kudos to him for doing a great episode. I'm glad he got his chance to do an important one like Fall of Centauri Prime.
Okay, good. We're done. We're so over time.
Excellent. Well, in case you guys want to contact us, you know, website babylonpodcast.com. Send us an email, babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Come to the forums, farpointforums.com. And also, call in our phone number. Leave us a voicemail. Get in there. Sneak in there between Gary and Neil. The phone number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year we were training super extra hard with our fighting poles.
Woo! Happy New Year!
And I'll see you next time on the other side of the happy ending.